On this week's show, Real Talk with Rob Sloyer from Cass Construction. All right, Nathan Wood, back at the wheel, getting it done. This is one we've been waiting for, man.
Oh, man. It's so much fun when you actually get to chat with someone that you know and can, you know, point out all their, not flaws, but, you know, their shining moments, you know. We'll get into it. You'll see.
We'll get into it. And that, he's referring to Rob Sloyer. Rob, it is awesome to sit down with you again, talk to you, get you on the show, catch up and see where you're at. How's things right now? Where are you?
Good, man. I'm actually in my backyard down in Florida. So apologies for those of the folks in the rest of the country that are still dealing with bomb cyclone number two or three or whatever. But I am a Florida boy, so I am also in my fleece because it's like 60 degrees. So.
Oh, he's 60 degrees and he's fleeced up. Listen, you guys know all about what I've been saying, following us on social media. It'll be interesting, though, because, you know, following us and posting and maybe tagging us gets you on the show sometimes. Rob Sloyer got an article on last week's Contact Crew News. So you never know when we're going to call you out. So follow us on those social media and check us out at youtube.com/@TheContactCrew. I'm watching and you guys are subscribing.
Are you tired of all the talk about solving the industry's problems and you just want to roll up your sleeves with the industry's best and brightest? Well, the CPC's returning to Denver, Colorado from April 8th to 10th for the 5th annual AEC Integration Summit. That's right, participate in one of the four teams' topics, from frictionless change orders to AI for issue resolution. Identify root causes of these shared pains and discover new approaches to solving. Learn more at constructionprogress.org/AECI Summit 26. The problems you learn to solve could be your own. Join us there.
All right. So, Rob, for those out there that don't know you and haven't come across you yet, give a little bit of a background. You've been in the industry for a while. So tell everybody your kind of story.
Yeah, sure. Been in the construction business in South Florida since 2001. Grew up as a Lego kid, Tinker Toy kid, stealing lumber to build tree forts in the woods kind of kid up in North Florida, and went to UF. Moved to South Florida in 2001 when I got out of grad school, a little early prior to finishing. I've been down here ever since. Worked for a GC initially that was primarily a school and municipal builder. We got acquired by one of the large publicly traded companies a couple years into my tenure there. Weathered the recession by being voluntold to be the BIM guy. So my undergrad was in architecture, and the company associated architecture with CAD, CAD with BIM, therefore you are the BIM guy. So that kept me employed through the recession, and came out the other side, went back to project management for a few years. And then the opportunity to come to Cast came up 10 years ago. I've been at Cast 10 years now. Initially came on board to start our VDC department at Cast, as well as just general construction technology and related things. And I was the first in a line of support departments. So we've since added quality, safety, scheduling, warranty/customer care. So it's expanded from there, all as kind of separate entities within the company. So today I manage our VDC group, also our Procore implementation and anything else that's construction specific technology. We always say we're not the IT guys. You don't want to fix your email, I promise. And then also work closely with our senior leadership on standards, procedures, that kind of stuff. My passion is really around improving things for the folks in the trailers. It's been a long time since I sat in a trailer. I don't know what it's like to do that today, but I know what it was like. And especially these days, sometimes that gets left behind. So try to be the voice of the field in those corporate level conversations and discussions.
The field needs its voice and they need somebody who's been through it. What was it like to, I mean, the recession was 2008, the BIM guy. What was that experience like? I mean, that's got to be, because you were running work before that. And so it was kind of like, okay, here's a whole new, how'd you tackle that?
Well, first I went back and Googled what is BIM. So thankfully Google existed already. And, you know, we had a guy in our local market. I think you guys know him or know of him, David Thirlwell. He was kind of the original South Florida BIM guy. And I was lucky enough to get introduced to him, and he kind of helped teach me what I needed. You know, like back then, Navis, Revit, everything was bought separately. There's no doing it on a laptop. You know, in 2009, that was all desktop. So I really just approached it with the skills that I guess I had, which was a combination of going through the gauntlet of undergrad design school and just getting crucified every time you go to present your work. So you get a thick skin and you get really good at kind of defending your and explaining your position. And then the skills that I had developed in the project management side of just, you know, everything is planning, scheduling, budgeting, and just using those same skills. So that's kind of my approach. And then just baptism by fire, you know, try to figure it out back then.
Man, well, now I have to tell a story, because I bet there's a lot of folks that are on the Slack group that I think it's now technically the Contact Forum, but it used to always be BIM and Beers, and that originated out of the South Florida BIM group. Do you want to tell a little bit of that story of kind of how all that came together? Or I think that's my understanding. Or you tell me.
No, yeah, that's accurate. I mean, the OGs back in the day were like me, David Thirlwell, Chris Lengiza, a few other guys that were just, you know, you don't hear the term so much anymore, but back then everybody talked about lonely BIM, because you were probably by yourself in your company. You know, the only person you had to talk to might have been a competitor. We went to an event called BIM and Bagels, and it was a little more corporate, a little more like there for sort of marketing purposes and that kind of thing. And I just smarted off one day and said, you know, we need to have a BIM and beer where the guys doing the work sit around and have a couple brews and, you know, real talk about what's going on and learning from each other too. You know, made a lot of those relationships, and there's still people, you know, Chris and I are still friends today. David and I are still friends today, and I still reach out to them for things that I need and vice versa. So it was, eventually somebody, a corporate entity stole the name and then sort of copyrighted it and sort of threatened to sue us. And we kept using our own name. So, for a while there, it was BIM and BIR, because we were worried about, you know, none of us had any money to be going getting sued or defending our intellectual property. But the group, David still does a good job of kind of manage that group and get people together. If you are in the South Florida market, we do have a WhatsApp group, so we'll try to find us and we'll add you to the group, but we do still get together from time to time.
Awesome. I mean, just the power of community, right? Because like I was part of the Bay Area kind of BIM community, and I know there's like a Phoenix has a big community, but yeah, South Florida, I think, was one of the ones that surprised me that there was such a BIM, such an early BIM community down there. So yeah, that is a cool story. I think a lot of folks don't know that now very large with a lot of folks on it. Slack group got started out of South Florida.
Yeah, and it's expanded too. You know, so many people around the country that have been added over time. So there's Paul Hedgepath, people like that are, I mean, even you, like that's how I met a lot of you guys, either directly or indirectly through that. So
yeah, shout out to Mark Decker
travel.
Too. Yeah, all the folks there.
Yeah, Decker.
Yeah, yeah, keeping the fire,
DJ.
Fire lit. Yeah, DJ Phipps, exactly. So yeah, throwing out all the old names, huh, Jeff?
I was going to say, that's like the OG run back here too. And you
got to listen back to like the 100s episodes.
Yeah, you got to go back to the early days. Chris and I were in the 20s. So Lengiza was on, was probably the part impetus to me learning what it's like to be in Rob's shoes, because I was an IT guy and was listening to Chris on the show about all the things you could do with BIM and virtual reality and augmented reality. And I went running into the masonry company like, this is what we're going to do. And I ran directly into a wall and found out that certain technologies not built for certain things wasn't quite ready yet. So and that community became like a sounding board for all of us. It created, you know, and then it was, you know, we'd meet at shows and on the road and out other places and have those conversations, right? We've always said the BIM and beer conversation was better than sometimes on the stage, just because on the stage you're always trying to bring you know, information to everybody at every level, right? Like they're not out in those communities. They're not out having those conversations. And so how do you have the further conversation? Well, that's the hallway. So also, I mean, we all sort of helped each other figure it out. I think we still, there's a still a quality of needing to help each other out, but we've all had to grow. So talk about, you're now, you've passed through the trailer seats, you've passed through the BIM seats, you've moved into that technology space and watched it grow and sort of become the organizational piece of it. You're doing more beyond just, you know, solving your own problems. So talk about how that shift's been for you over time.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that actually over the weekend. It occurred to me that in May it'll be 25 years, and was thinking about when I started, the technology was the fax machine and the Nextel. I literally did not have a corporate email address for the first maybe year, 2 years of my career. You know, I think I went and got like a Hotmail somewhere to be able to send stuff on, like on my own. You know, so that was the technology, like the fax machine, the cover letters, the paper cuts from the 12 copies of every submittal, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, I think the you know, we all have know kind of those big milestones along the way. You know, BIM really started to, I think, create a space where you could have somebody dedicated to that role within a construction company. And then, you know, some of us just started latching on to other things, you know, found out about Bluebeam, iPads came out, figured out how to get the drawings on the iPad, you know, through a cloud server. And it was, for me, it was really always just, you know, I jokingly say you always want the smart, lazy guy, right? I don't know how smart I am, but I definitely qualify on the lazy part. Like, hold on a minute. I can either carry this giant roll of half-size drawings out to the field and that no one else can see, or I can take this iPad out, you know? So like coming out of the recession, the company I was with got a large municipal project in downtown Fort Lauderdale. I still have a picture where I had, I think 13 iPads sitting on my counter. I had no idea what I was doing, just trying to figure out how to get the iPad set up. I think that was the most you could have on one iCloud account. So because we bought as many as we could for one iCloud account and got the tech out there. But that job was really a great experience because I was back on site, mostly full time, and really learning to the stereotypes of this person or that person that's not going to use technology probably aren't correct. You know, you can have a young kid that wants nothing to do with it, that maybe got into construction because he wanted nothing to do with it. You know, I had an old superintendent come in and set the iPad down on the counter and say, "You got any trigonometry apps you can give me?" You know, and I'm looking at this like Willie Nelson looking dude going, "What in the hell is he going to do with a trigonometry app?" But he was an old surveyor and layout guy, and he wanted an easier way to do the math. So that was the gateway to getting him in, you know. And then I think the other big thing has been the COVID era that really finally got the last of the holdouts into the cloud, at least for us. You know, we had people that still wanted to VPN into the local server and carry around their half size drawings and suddenly wanting better access to the files and the data and that kind of stuff pushed. That was kind of the last thing that pushed everybody into the cloud.
So Rob, I wonder, you know, now in 2026, the flip side of that, of you've now got this generation that has only known the iPad world, has never seen what it's like to slip sheet a drawing set and really understand like the manual process of what it takes to keep a drawing set updated. And that's why I used to always love about doing Bluebeam trainings, because like all those tool sets, all those little buttons and things, they would mimic what you would do in a paper-based world, because that's essentially what we're doing, is we're replicating those processes of change management, of drawing versioning, of all these other things. And I think somehow, like with so much of this tech, like you miss what you had to do to get there. And like, I guess, are you teaching that? Does that matter? Like, what are you seeing with the newer generation coming in?
We're trying to keep, I think you've heard me say this before, but you've made the comment before about we digitize bad process, you know, and my twist on that is, no, we digitize good process, right? It was good paper-based process. Like, we had no choice but to have 12 sets of the paper drawings. We had no choice but to mark them up and hand them off to the next person. That was the technology that was available at the time. And in a lot of ways, we've digitized that process, and in some ways made it less good because it's hidden behind a veil of technology. And the value of the slow work is what I think we lost. If I got a stack of submittals, say duck workshop drawings, and I'm reviewing them literally red pen, you know, on the plan table, in the trailer, getting interrupted by people coming in, marking this up, I was way more incentivized to kick that back to the sub than I was to pass it on downstream, you know? So we should always be trying to improve things as we hand them off, right? Anything we take in and we give to somebody else, we should be making it better before we get it to the next person. And so sometimes that means, hey, this isn't good enough to make better. I need to give it back to the first person. So I would look at that somewhat selfishly and again, maybe lazily, and go, I'm not going to copy 300 comments onto 12 sets of drawings. I'm going to give this back to the sub. We're going to get on a call. We're going to talk about it. I'm going to revise it and fix it before we pass it on. Now, the digital process, it's way easier to just pass that forward. And we lose that, you know, that value of the slower work. What I'm interested in with the technology sort of today and where we're going is, do we start to give people back some of that time to actually do the slow work that we want them to do? What I worry about is where I hear people say like, oh, we're going to automate, say, submittal review. Automate submittal review, that's a key training tool for how people learn and grow. So if I'm busy training the model, does that mean I'm not training my person? And are they now losing that ability to learn about mechanical systems, plumbing systems, you know, masonry, drywall, acoustic treatments, like all these things, orchestra pit lifts. I had orchestra pit lift on my first big job, right? Like this opportunity that if the tool just reviewed the orchestra pit lift and sent it on, I wouldn't, not that I've encountered another one since then, but if I do, I'm ready because I actually had to learn something about it in the process.
Well, in that process that you're talking about, that's how you learn a job too. Not just your job itself, but that job you're working on now. Because, you know, we talk about those spec lists, we talk about what we're seeing, but that's also design intent. It's calling out what the customer, client, end user really wants out of their product when you're done building it. And so the machine can never really know that. I mean, it can know a little bit, but it would be better to have time to think, right?
The only way it can get better is by learning from mistakes. And the only way it can learn from mistakes is by us admitting that mistakes happen and feeding them into the machine. And that comes back to this whole privacy, you know, comfort with sharing information and what is the risk exposure. And, you know, Rob, I know that's the stuff you love to dig into on LinkedIn. Like all the really messy stuff. Like there is no right answer, right?
The whole before the, I guess I'm going to be the first one to say the word, before the AI explosion, we all wanted was to share data in an anonymized way. We wanted, you know, these big project management solutions. We asked them questions about, hey, what are other people doing? What's a typical RFI response time you're seeing? And then now we've moved into this new scary future, I guess, and nobody wants to share their data. You know, it's all like, oh, I want the model trained on everyone's data except mine. And I don't want to share mine to help train the model, you know. So I think it's definitely an interesting topic around, you know, not only who owns it, but, you know, who owns the device it's being stored on. Are they due money to store your data? Should we or should we not be using it to train the model? You know, I'm like super interested in what we could learn if we were actually able to sort of reliably train the model on reliably anonymized data, you know?
That is the conundrum, right? Because you want it. And what's interesting too is, and we, you know, we can take this all the way back to an individual company level. Like that data is only valuable at your company level if everybody participating in the company is feeding that data in. I've come across multiple companies where it's like, oh yeah, we have like, say you got a Procore. Yeah, 80% of the people projects use Procore. What do the other 20% use? Well, they haven't really come along and that group specializes in doing X, Y, and Z. And so we just let them on their own. And I'm like, so you're blind to 20% of your company. And most of the time that's the 20% that's probably driving more revenue, driving more work. And it might even be riskier work. So you're like, the totality of the data is the important part. And I totally understand, like, who owns it? You know, how can we make sure that it's anonymized? I'm thinking about this from like a plans perspective. That is architects' IP, and very important that, you know, they hang on to that IP. But it's also contributing to an industry that's building the world around us that needs to know more about what's working and what's not working. And I'm with you, Nathan. We love to share our successes. I don't know that in the data we share our failures as often as we should.
Well, I think that's the cultural mindset, is that when you're inside the fence, when you're inside a cast, you should want to share everything, because everything should be fair game, because you're not at risk to yourself other than feeling ashamed or something. When it goes over the fence outside of the company, that's where we have to talk about strategy and risk and what should I share or should I not. And that's the whole team topic at the AEC Integration Summit this year, is should I share or should I not. But I think internally, I guess, Rob, where do you feel like, you know, things are at with building that culture that says, hey, when it's inside the fence, like, of course we're going to open the kimonos and share our faults and share whatever, because we should be learning from that. I know that's a very big stretch to say that you're there, but like, how close are you?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges is that, you know, if we go back 10 years to sort of the Power BI analytics, data is going to change the world trend. You know, I said back then there's the stages of data analytics. Stage one is figure out what you want to measure. Stage two is figure out how to measure it. Stage three is figure out how to report it. Stage four is figure out it's all crap and start over again. And if you look at, I would say that back then, maybe 10 to 20% of the companies were really trying to do something, with analytics. And you fast forward to today and, you know, it's maybe 10% aren't trying to do something with AI. And, you know, we talked for years about structured and unstructured data. I don't think we have a structure problem so much anymore. There's not as much of like handwritten notes in the yellow notebook. There's not as much of scanned in, hand filled out sheets. What we have now is a governance problem. It's the same, but almost worse, because it's digital, people think it's accurate and trustworthy and correct. You know, a few months ago, I asked the top three or four different AI tools what the code allowed drop from floor drain to a P-trap was. They all answered it differently and they all got it wrong. Even when you're talking about internal data, I'm really keen on some ideas around being able to leverage AI to make the job easier, but also provide the training. I want to bring Clippy back, but I want Clippy to be a RFI Clippy that like bounces around and gives you suggestions on how to make your RFI better. But we had to be really careful about what we feed that as part of that training topic. You know, we could easily have RFIs within the company that have been answered wrong. And again, lack of knowledge, the person that's probably processing them is not necessarily the most knowledgeable and experienced person. We send an RFI over, junior architect answers it, PE gets it back, they mark it closed, right? Their incentive, and I guess this goes too to sort of the how to do it internally, we had to be careful that those incentives don't become disincentives. We start grading people on RFI response time. You know, Nathan, you always say, show me how I'm measured, I'll show you how I'm gonna act, right? If you're graded on RFI response time, you're not graded on good, you're not graded on code compliant, you're not graded on anything else, you're just like, hey, I got to get my number down, and you just start hammering away at closing RFIs. I think we do want to share internally, but we kind of need like grown-up eyes and grown-up hands on that sharing, and what do we use to train those models even internally.
Yeah, see, that's a beautiful use case for what AI can do for you. If you take that RFI Clippy, which somebody's going to steal that from you, so you know, we'll try to give you credit. It'll at least be on here. But that RFI Clippy should be telling you the RFI has particular structure and things it's got to go, especially could change from job to job depending on the contract. It can walk you through that, telling you what these sections need to be, not what needs to be in them, and requiring you to learn and go out and get that information and provide it and read it. And by the way, everybody, this is what they're getting wrong, I think, is everybody's like, AI can make you 50%, you know, faster. You can do, you know, 50 RFIs in the time of one. Well, you're right, Rob. That's the disincentive. But what if I can do three or four more RFIs at a higher quality because I'm not having to learn what the format necessarily is for this exact job and make sure I'm putting in that wording. It's helping me with the basic languages in between, right? Because an RFI has a lot of detail that's required each time, but a lot of that's not thought, date, you know, other specific things that aren't, you can be pulled from the data. That's fine. It's the, if that spec itself, or if that, you know, is meeting the intention or is safe, right?
Well, I think it could, we can also use it as a tool. There's a, to me, there's kind of two, if we just stick with the RFI example, there's sort of two tiers of how we can use it. One is best practices. Do you comply with company standards? Maybe a little bit of extra sauce of saying, hey, if you didn't cite a drawing, we find that RFIs that cite drawings get answered 25% faster, little things like that. But the other piece is that actually replacing that, what I'm worried that we're going to lose is that ability to train in the process. You know, last year at CPC, I went to Raising Cane's. I'd never been there before. I walk in, I said, it's right across from the hotel. I said, hey, I want some chicken fingers. And they go, okay. A four piece or a six piece? A four piece. Do you want soda or not? Yes. You know, do you want fries? Yes. And as I left, I realized, well, now I've been trained by the model, right? Next time I come in, I'm going to say, I want a four piece with fries and a Coke. Please stop talking to me. Let me get the hell out of here. I'm surrounded by college students, right? I want to go. But I, that's the kind of thing that I envision these tools really bringing to the table and helping us grow our people is, you know, being able to sit down and say, remember that video, The Steel Will Not Work? Little cartoon guys. I reposted it on LinkedIn the other day. Sit down and start to write an RFI and say the duct does not fit. And then it prompts you back and says, okay, what duct? Well, the duct above the meeting room. Okay. I see in the drawings, you have five meeting rooms. Which meeting room? The one on level three, right? And then get more detailed. Hey, I see that, you know, it. Why won't it work? Well, it's hitting the steel. Okay, I see these joists in that space. The next time that person sits down to write that RFI or a similar RFI, maybe there are people out there that are just going to want to sit there and be dental parented, but like the most people, I think, are going to want to skip to the end, right? So they're going to go, okay, the system's going to start asking me these questions. Now I know ahead of time what to go look at, what to learn, you know. And I think anybody that's really, the term gets overused, anybody that's a builder in the business is going to have that level of interest to say, oh, these are the things I need to be looking at. These are how I get questions answered. You know, what would be great is if you get to the end and it's, as architects love to say, this is not an RFI. It's already in the drawing. Be awesome if the tool just came out and told you that from the beginning. Like, just FYI, I do see a detail for a drop soffit in that area. Maybe put the ductwork in there.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think here's your holy grail of that Clippy AI example is, what is the RFI? Because you said before, there's an RFI that could be asked that could be answered wrong, but you would never know it until maybe 2 years later when you're installing the other piece of equipment that is now the reason why it's wrong. But when you write that RFI, where's Clippy to show up and go, hey, by the way, this other RFI was asked and answered 2 years ago in that exact same area. And now you can go flag that one as being a bad RFI and not being the correct answer and actually like cleaning up the data as you go. Because like, yeah, if we don't create systems that both govern and clean the data simultaneously, we're never going to, you know, make up for everything we've lost along the way. But yeah, I think these are all, yeah, great strategies and stuff I know you're implementing. So keep going.
Well, that's a great training opportunity as well, right? Because we have so many people in the industry, like we're trying very hard to retain people, but the way the industry has changed, one of the ways it's changed in my tenure is you see a lot of these people move every 2 years, every year, every 18 months, they're a new company. You know, you're just getting settled and starting to actually be helpful and learning things. And somebody gets you another 10 grand, so you're off to down the road. That forward-looking vision, right, to your specific example, Nathan, when they get reminded later on, hey, you mentioned the air handler isn't fitting. Remember 2 years ago when you asked about the duct that wouldn't fit in the meeting room and we told you there's an air handler? Like, that's the kind of training. Like, I see experience getting more and more poo-pooed in the industry. Maybe as I get older and all I have to offer is experience, I get testy about it. But yeah, I think those are the kinds of things that I would love to find a way to accelerate that learning, you know, and bring that in as part of that training and have those more forward-looking things, you know, maybe even prompting that person, hey, I noticed there's also an air handler in this space, you know, did you want to maybe look at that too? Oh, yes, right? Because I had a superintendent one time that said, I don't always know the right way to do it, but I know a crap load of not ways to do it.
That's totally valid, right? And your prompting thing there and just any way of using the software for that kind of feedback and training also hits on this new generation wants to make an impact faster. They're used to a shorter feedback loop. I mean, we used to have these conversations back in the day about, like, you know, most millennials at the time I was doing studies were leaving their jobs after, you know, under a year because they didn't feel as though they were having an impact on the company, and impact was what they wanted. Well, you, all of us know it takes a lot longer to create those relationships that do create that impact. But if we can speed up their impact on, in that case, if you look at that and they find the air handler and they get ahead of it, then when somebody's building it, they're like, wow, that was great. You took care of that ahead of time for me. Now they get the impact. Now they feel like they're being valued, and that goes to retention. The moving every 18 months to 2 years, some of that we've created ourselves. Some of it is the money, right? There are people who are going to chase that 10 grand everywhere they go. But a lot of them, how are you approaching, hey, we're going to give you more than just that 10 grand. You're going to learn. We're going to give you a something more.
Yeah. Well, and you know, look, everything post recession has been up, right? You know, depending on where you live, there might have been a COVID dip. Not in Florida, we stayed open, but some regions may have had an economic dip during that time. But really, we've just been on this rocket ship of growth for 15 years, and a lot of those people were not around for the recession. You know, you talked about what changed. One of the things that changed was my ego. As I came out of school and was getting recruited and headhunted and thought I was amazing, and then all of a sudden everybody around me is getting laid off and I'm getting shoved in the BIM closet to not get fired. You know, that experience of that recession, I think for those of us that went through it, kind of gave us a different perspective on the economy, the industry, and that kind of stuff. But, you know, that too has led to that rapid moving, you know, and I keep thinking about the labor shortage. And even on the project management superintendent side, I'm not entirely sure we're not just all passing the same people around. You know, like they're saying, like, oh, we're short 40% of what we need. And I think it's probably really more like we're short 60%. We just all keep, like, you know, we're counting the guy that's starting next week and the other guy's not counting him as being gone yet. So we're just kind of, I think we can address some of that with the technology tools as well, right? That if we can make people feel appreciated, feel like they're contributing, you know, I guess my pushback to that would be what I would tell any younger person getting into the business today is, if, like, you want to have an impact, go outside and find somebody to help. And that was my key to my early career success was, I got into this business to not, ironically now, I spent all my time inside, but I got into this business to go outside, and going outside and engaging with the supers and the trade foremen and all the people out there. What do you need? What can I do to help? Like, start at your own project with the impact you can have and look for those people that need help. And they are probably outside. The people that need help are probably outside.
Yeah. The ones putting in the work are the ones that need the most help, because we need them not doing paperwork and not filling out forms, and we need them installing work and thinking about that flow and productivity and keeping people safe. So it's a great lesson. And I think it's a lesson, and I'm going to spin you to this because we're getting close to the end. And I do want you to get a little bit of this out there. I think the software companies should have less of the salespeople out there and more of the people that are the technical support, the ones that know the tools, learning from the problems more frequently. And now you sit in that role, Rob, where, you know, you have to field a lot of this. You have that killer word. You have innovation in your title, buddy, which, you know, is just a LinkedIn search away. It's a sales navigator search away from a phone call. So talk a little bit about how that process is for you now and sort of your feedback on it.
Yeah, I think it's completely overwhelming. And the amount of time that we spend fending that off, filtering it, you know, even sometimes internally, somebody will get a hold of somebody at a project team, get them all excited about something. Now I'm fending off the salesperson and my own internal person. you know, the data guy that we brought on recently came from a consulting firm, and now has a data title at a construction company, you know, and I comes to my office one day, he's like, what the hell? Like, I can't get anything done. All I'm doing is spending, this unwanted attention. In my mind, I always equate it to that old meme of like the woman walking down a street past a construction site in New York and getting like whistled at. And I wonder, like, did that work? Did that ever one time work? You know, did all this cold calling ever harassing me, all this stuff that ever really work? You know, I think what I want is, again, I think the same advice is there, go outside. We're Bridget Bench customers. I think they have an awesome like founding story of, you know, the two women that founded that company went to job sites and asked people what was wrong, you know? And they weren't from industry. I get a lot of, you know, I say all the time, I don't really want to talk to people not from industry and that kind of stuff, but entirely true. But I think they did it the right way. They went out and they didn't say, you know, we're here to fix you. You're broken. Your industry stinks. You're inefficient. You know, like, great way to piss anybody off is say, I'm here to disrupt you. Like, great. Yeah, I'm closing the door. You're done. I'm not interested in being disrupted. Thank you very much. But I think they really went about it the right way of just, they saw an opportunity in the construction industry. They didn't know what specifically that opportunity was. And they just went out and asked questions. You know, they didn't show up with a preconceived notion about, you know, I made an app to plan temp toilet locations, you know, okay. Not interested in that. Nope. Nobody needs that. But here's like 25 other things we need help with. You know, don't put AI on the end of your tool and then think I'm going to buy it because it's now the temp toilet AI location tool. You know, like engage with the people. I think going on podcasts like this, that's where I learn a lot of stuff. That's where I even get my mind changed sometimes about, I heard an interview from a vendor on a podcast a couple weeks ago, and it was somebody we'd kind of been shutting down, and they started really talking through it on the interview. And I was like, they had acquired another vendor as well. And at first I'm like, I don't know what these two things have anything to do with each other. And then they kind of start explaining, I'm like, holy crap, that's a great idea. I totally see a use case for that. That's absolutely something that we could use. I may steal that idea and go build it myself with our own tools, but you know, nonetheless, the good idea is there, and it opens up the door to having this conversation, because it really is. It's just completely overwhelming, the volume of like cold calling, email.
Yeah.
I keep joking that I'm going to put Calendly where you can schedule, click here to schedule time with me. It's going to be behind a paywall, you know, like I'll talk to you for $100, you know, we'll donate it to the pet rescuer. I got my dog, but there's gotta be some.
I mean, that really is, you hit a couple of things, and I say this over and over, and I want you to take this one with you. Disruption is not an outcome. It's not a goal. Is the unfortunate byproduct. So Uber, those two guys wanted to get a cab in London and couldn't. And then had the same experience in San Francisco and said, what if we could call them to us with this mobile device thing we have? And that was, they were solving the problem that they just wanted to get a ride faster. Same thing. You can't go out there with, I'm going to disrupt as the goal. It's always going to fail. Go out and search for the problems. And there's so many of those, like Bridget Bench that did it, and others that have gone out and just spent the time investigating the problem, or were living the problem in construction and moved over to a founder or whatnot on a technical founder that they went to solve it. So that's the important thing. And I'm with you at this point in time, and it's a little self-serving, but going on and explaining what you're actually trying to achieve through the workflows, through the changes on shows like this and others. There's lots of great shows out there right now that talk about different things. That's where you go to learn. And then I can come to you with a story that makes sense and you have a problem you want to solve. And by the way, you hit on something else. And I think it's something all of us in software need to kind of think about is with AI and with Claude and all these other new tools that you can do, you can, and most startups can solve almost any problem. It's just, does it matter? And do you know what an industry standard is? What a workflow should look like? Can you help not only bring them the software, but actually solve a problem and then get adoption across the company? Because that's the biggest hurdle, right? I can get one project team. I can get a couple of people in my BIM group to do something new. But if I want to go across the company and get standardization and get adoption, that's not easy.
Yeah. Well, and I think the folks, some of the folks coming out of industry and starting these technology companies, right? Some of them we use, some of them are, I see value in that we don't yet use. But a lot of them, what I see is people that, you know, they might be creating a unitasker to solve the thing that they didn't like doing when they were a PE or an APM or a PM. But what they don't understand is the upstream and downstream knock-on effects of both the value of what they were doing. And that's a problem for people like me. I should be doing a better job of explaining that. Like, hey, look, I know this kind of sucks, but this is why you need to do it. And here's how to go find your own personal value in what you're doing, right? Everybody wants daily report tools, right? And it's all, a lot of them were built by guys that had to fill out daily reports and didn't like it. I would make the argument you're viewing the daily report wrong. The daily report is the report itself is the trash. It's the out, it's the leftover. The value is sitting down, thinking about your day. What did I do today? Who was here? Who wasn't here? What was supposed to start that didn't start? I don't need an AI tool to spit that out at me for me to ignore and put in an email and send to the office. I should be, you know, when I did the daily logs, I was end of the day, everybody else is gone, the supers are gone for the day. I've got the daily reports from the trades, I've got notes from the supers. Let me sit down and think about what happened today. And I can't tell you how many times I would think I would get to a point and go, well, I don't know if that did or didn't happen. And I'm there at like 5 o'clock at night, 6 o'clock at night in the trailer, get up and go back out to the job site to see if it happened or not. That's an example of like, the value is so vast upstream and downstream, training people, getting the proper reporting. You know, the manpower count does matter because somebody's using that for an RIR, recordable incident rate somewhere. Those things all matter, but I liked doing the daily report because I finished my day, I figured out what did and didn't happen, and then I was prepared for the next day. The paper that I was writing it on was like, yeah, sure, you can make use of this, great, here, put that in a drawer somewhere. I already got what I needed. So I think for the founders and the startup folks that are a little bit of time in industry, get with somebody that, you know, got more time in industry, find out, hey, why do we do this? What's the history behind it? Why do we keep doing it? You know, and we're all about process improvement, but you got to think about how it fits in the larger ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, that's a beautiful tie back because we started this with, you wanted things when they were reading plans up front and they were planning and looking at specs, and you wanted them to learn the job, right? It's like, we can't be just clicking boxes and not learning this job. In that pre-con phase, you're learning the job. In construction, you're learning what's going on. You're staying on top of where you are in that construction. So that daily report is not just some piece of documentation that I have to do. What you're saying is the value is I'm learning the job of what's happening right now in a world where I can't see it all. On those jobs, I just can't see it all. And I need to know the gaps. So I think you've done a good job of tying it all the way through here, Rob, that it isn't about doing the job for you and clicking buttons. It's about educating and allowing you time to think through the job at every phase and understand your other partners as well in this process. Because when you're talking about, you know, the air handlers and the duct, you're talking about, you know, your sheet metal contractors, you're talking about your air conditioning contractors, you're talking about all these different people that you're eventually going to have to manage on a job site and have to have more time to understand. And it's a relationship business in the end of how we schedule work, how we coordinate, how we, you know, adapt to problems, et cetera. So if I can wrap it up, it's don't take it all away. Just make it a little bit easier for us to learn and engage. So hopefully that's a good wrap up, Rob, because it's been awesome to have you on the show, man.
Cool. Good to catch up with you guys again.
Anytime you have an open, an invite, if you guys aren't following Rob on LinkedIn,
oh, man,
you gotta go follow Rob on LinkedIn. You're going to get real talk, right? We need real talk. We need people who aren't afraid to, you know, give the good, the bad, and the ugly. So we appreciate you, Rob, man. Thanks for joining us today.
Cool. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Nathan Wood, it was good to see you. Looking forward to seeing you in person soon at the AEC Integration Summit. If y'all out there aren't signed up, get signed up right now and join us. It's getting close.
Absolutely.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Rob Sloyer. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is the Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.